Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to Bloodlines and Bestsellers. My name is Mal Warwick. I'll be the moderator for this panel with this distinguished family. I am a reviewer of books. I have a book review blog, and I chair the board of directors of the festival. So I'm very excited to be here for a number of reasons. So I'm going to begin by a few introductions, and then I'm going to ask some questions, and then I'm going to open it up to you. I'm hoping that we'll have plenty of time for some conversation. Excuse my voice. I had throat surgery recently, and it has affected me. So at the end, you'll have an opportunity to visit the bookstore outside and purchase and get signed copies of all three of their books. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Now, you know, if there were an aristocracy of mystery authors, here is the royal family. Together, their nearly 100 books have sold more than 100 million copies. They've appeared at or near the top of the New York Times bestseller list more times than I could possibly count. And the Kellermans are the only married couple ever to have appeared simultaneously on the New York Times bestseller list for two different books.
Twice.
But who's counting?
Didn't know that.
Just happened last year.
Oh, really? Wonderful. So, Jonathan Kellerman is the author of the 34 novels to date in the Alex Delaware series. It features a clinical psychologist, which Jonathan was for many years, who consults with the Los Angeles Police Department. His most recent book is The Wedding Guest. You saw a copy of it right here.
This is my PowerPoint.
The New York Journal of Books wrote that the novel, quote, proved once again why this series has become the longest running American crime series. Yeah. Faye Kellerman writes the Peter Decker and Rena Lazarus novels about a longtime LAPD homicide cop who converts to Orthodox Judaism to marry the woman he meets on a case. Her latest book is Walking Shadows, It's the 25th in the series. The Associated Press noted that Kellerman is, quote, in a class with the most literate, facile, and engaging writers in the business.
Oh. Didn't know.
Pretty impressive, huh? Jesse Kellerman has written 9 novels to date, including 4 co-authored with his father and 5 standalone mysteries. His most recent book is A Measure of Darkness. It's the second novel in the Clay Edison series he writes with Jonathan. Publishers Weekly noted about Jesse that, quote, Kellerman has a gift for creating compelling characters as well as for crafting an ingenious plot that grabs the reader and refuses to let go. All right. Now, I'm going to start with a couple of questions for all three of you. Okay. I want to start by talking about collaboration, which seems like an obvious question to ask. If there's any family in the history of literature that has collaborated so often and so closely in writing your books, I certainly don't know who it is. I've collaborated on a number of books as well, and I know that it doesn't always work out well, putting it mildly. Yet you seem to thrive when working together, and the books you co-author rack up very impressive sales figures. How far does your collaboration go? Do you work on each other's books even when your name isn't on the title page? And what happens when you don't like what the other one has done?
Never happens.
Do you want me to answer?
We don't work on the other person's solo books.
Faye's book, Jesse's book, they're their books, my books are my books. When Faye and I first started, and we were published a year apart, I was first published in 85, Faye was first published in 86, we were really neophytes and didn't know what we were doing. So what we would do is every Friday we would share a week's worth of work, and there were some chilly nights. You know, you really have to learn how to do it. You know, you get no training in this. You get no training in publicity. You get no training in anything. It's just one of the things that you teach yourself. As we gained more confidence, we showed each, this is just Faye and myself, we showed each other larger and larger segments. And now we don't show each other the books till they're completed. So those are separate. Same thing, obviously, with the standalones that Jesse did. Collaboration has proved to be very, very pleasant. I have to be careful because sometimes we're accused of being too nice or too, you know, there's not enough drama. But we really don't have a lot of drama when it comes to writing. Faye and I co-wrote two books together, and we didn't do it face-to-face. You want to talk about how we did it?
Yes. First of all, thank you all for coming down at 10 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning. It is not an easy thing. I'm still drinking coffee at this time usually. So thank you very much for coming. As John said, I don't think you can collaborate until you really feel comfortable in your own skin. And it takes quite a few books in writing because, as John said, nobody teaches you how to do it. There are no rules for this kind of thing. It's not like being a doctor or being a psychologist or a dentist. Believe it or not, I went to dental school many, many moons ago. So you kind of have to figure it out yourself. And anytime it's kind of autodidactic, you're a little bit on shaky grounds. So it took a good 10 books for us that we did solo before we decided to do our first collaborative effort. There was no drama because we didn't talk to each other when we did it. When you talk to the person that you're collaborating with, you're reading a lot more than what their words are saying. You're seeing signs, you're seeing twitches, and sometimes you read into it where there's nothing to read into. We did everything by email. And as a result of that, there was no emotional overload. You looked at the words. It was almost like getting an editorial letter. And sometimes it was a relief to collaborate because when I write mystery novels and I paint myself into corners, there's only one person who can get myself out of the corners. This time I did a lot of corners and then said, let him figure it out.
For me, it was very typical because we've been married for 46 years and I've constantly been saying, please take care of me. So, you know, I just pass her a draft. Now, with Jesse and myself, it was a little different. Jesse, in addition to being a novelist, is an award-winning playwright. He won the Princess Grace Award for Best Young Playwright in America when he was like 22. And he got published at the age of 25, very young, as a novelist, had a bestseller. And so he did a bunch, and our collaboration was kind of happenstance. I had started a book outside the series. I've also written, you know, several non-series books. And I put it down because I was busy, and Jesse and his wife and children were visiting us. And I just mentioned, I started this thing, it's overwhelming. So he took a look at it. He said, well, why don't we try to write it together? So we did, and we sold it, and we had a bestseller, and then we decided to keep doing it. I'll let Jesse talk, but from my perspective, I don't think we've exchanged an unfriendly syllable since we started.
No. So I'll talk about our recent collaboration in a moment. I would just say that, you know, obviously my relationship to my parents is very different from their relationship with each other. And in terms of sharing my own work with them, you know, that's, as a child, that's what you do. You bring your parents, you know, the thing that you're proud of. So I started writing at a very, very young age, and I would write these little stories, I'd write these little plays, and I'd bring them to my parents to show them. And it took many years before I was able to write something without showing it to them after 10 pages or 50 pages for approval. Even my first couple novels, I remember sending, like, every 50 pages I would send to them because as my dad said, there's no real good training for this except the experience of doing it, and you feel like you're groping around a lot in the beginning. Now, after, you know, 10 books in, it I feel a little more confident, and I can write at greater length without having to get a seal of approval before moving on. With respect to our collaboration, yes, it's true. We have not had any conflict. I think both of us recognize that the relationship is more important than the collaboration. And so we are very careful to, be respectful toward each other. I think the other aspect of it is that when we're dealing with each other in a collaborative mode, we're two professionals. And as a professional, I respect what he has to say. I take seriously what he has to say, and vice versa. And I think we're both interested in the same goal, which is producing a great book. And if you are interested in the book itself, the product itself, rather than, stroking your own ego, you take good advice when you hear good advice. And I think that's one of the hardest things for young writers to do, because you don't have that confidence yet. And you're battling for every word. I love good editorial advice. There's lots of crappy editorial advice as well, and learning to sort those out is another thing that you learn over time. But I welcome the chance to get the work itself improved, and that's something that I think we've managed to, again, with no real training. There's no playbook for how you collaborate with somebody. There's no rules. We've just sort of improvised this system, and it works. So,
well, and the other thing is, like, I think of it as like playing in a band. Writing a novel by yourself is being up there with that violin or that piano or that guitar soloing. When you're playing with other people, and I've done that, and Jesse has and Faye has, you want people with good chops, what we call good chops, good inherent ability. So you play with great musicians, you're going to play better. And I'm very, very fortunate that both the people next to me, I'm not saying this because they're my relatives, are really, really talented writers. So it just makes it easier. They don't hand in crap, you know. When Jesse sends me something, I send him something. It's high quality, and I respect it. That's why I didn't collaborate with anyone else, because I didn't want to be in a position of not feeling good about it. But when people are already very, very talented, it just makes it easier.
Yeah, our type of collaboration is not like two people writing in the same room, a comedy writer or something like that. Even when we're collaborating, this is how it was with Jesse, with Jonathan, and when I wrote a book with my daughter. We write separately. There's nobody over our shoulder. So we're sent a body of work that maybe my daughter did or Jonathan did, and I look it over, and I kind of edit it. Then I go on, and then I send it to him for him to do approval. So in each phase, we are each other's editor as well as the writer. So it's not as a team. It's a collaboration, but it's not a team in the same room. So it makes it very much like your own solo work.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process. I mean, Jesse was in the world of theater, so the collaboration is quite different.
Yeah.
I mean, you're dealing with people, and I did a little comedy writing in college, and that's the kind of writing that really benefits from two or three or four people sitting in the same room and throwing stuff back and forth. What we do is send drafts back and forth, and email is just miraculous for that.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah. Very, very informative. So now a question about Judaism. You're all observant Orthodox Jews, and some of the books in Faye's series even include detail about Jewish religious practices. Mm-hmm. Also, Jonathan and Jesse have co-authored two books, The Golem of Hollywood and The Golem of Paris, which are based on Jewish mythology. In what other ways, if any, do you feel your practice of Judaism has influenced your writing?
For me, it has been part and parcel of my series. It was set out to have an Orthodox female character because I wanted to explore Orthodox feminism and an Orthodox female, and I felt I was the right person to do it. So she was developed even before my cop. I wanted to write mysteries specifically because mysteries have a start, a middle, and an end. And it gave me structure, because when I first started writing, everybody has 3 or 4 books or maybe 10 books that they write before they get their first published book. I was floundering. I thought this was interesting, and I thought that was interesting. And at the time, I said, well, maybe I'll write kind of something semi-autobiographical. And then I discovered I just wasn't interesting enough. I better start, you know, elaborating and making it up. So she, the idea of adding religion to flavor my crime novels was deliberate. Since then, I've written 34 books with them, something like that. And some are more religious themed than others. Some are more straight crime novels. I have since moved my characters, who have aged with me, though not as quickly, to another small town in New York. They were originally in Los Angeles. Now they're in New York, in a small town upstate, specifically in a small police department, so I could get Rena involved more, because some of my fans, and I felt this way too, felt that Rena over the series was kind of getting lost. And she had a lot to say, and she had a lot to do, and she was an extremely, extremely bright woman, and I wanted to involve her more. I really, really do like her. And since the series is involved, at first she was quite religious, now she's a little bit more normative, modern Orthodox Judaism, which I can relate to better. So that was a thing that was deliberately done, and it served me very, very well. I love my religion, and I think it's interesting, and a lot of people other than Jews think it's interesting, and I get letters from everybody, and it's very rewarding.
Do you want to take a go? For me, I've come to think of myself more traditional Jew than Orthodox Jew. After 9/11, I had an epiphany that religious extremism was a source of great problem in the world. And I don't want to be part of that, of any religion. I love Judaism. I was raised, for me it was simple, I was raised with it. I went to seminary. It's something I really like. It's meaningful to me. It's a great way to raise kids. They turn out great. When I embarked on becoming a novelist, I assiduously avoided doing anything Jewish. First of all, like many writers, I like to write about things that trouble me. And religion was not a source of conflict for me. It was very easy wear, because I was born to it. 3 generations. It's just the way I was. And I didn't really wrestle with it much. What did bother me was child abuse and how gay people were treated in the 80s, and just the notion that L.A. was a third world country with extremes on both ends. So I also wanted to be a universalist writer. I really wanted it to appeal to as many people as I could, and that's worked out. Thank God. I never saw it as a job. I never thought I'd be earning a living. I was working as a child clinical psychologist at Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, running a program for kids with cancer, and then in private practice. My first novel, the advance was so small, like $3 an hour, I could have flipped burgers and done better. And then to my amazement, the book started selling, so I kept doing it. So I've just tried to write about things that trouble me. And since my religion really doesn't trouble me, now, the Golem books are interesting. I don't see them as religious books. I just thought, Faye and I were in Prague, and I said, wow, this whole city is built around 2 things, the Golem and Kafka. And if you've been there, you have Golem burgers made out of pork, which is interesting. So I was so entranced by the whole thing, and that's how that started.
You want to say anything?
Yeah, so I think like a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of different flavors of Judaism. I think like a lot of people who come from the background that I come from, similar to the background my father comes from, raised in a modern Orthodox environment, we're not unidimensional people, obviously. There's a lot of different parts to me and to each of us, and Judaism is a significant part, but it's not the only part. So when it comes to our writing, we bring to the table whatever is most compelling to us at that particular moment. When I wrote my standalone novels, there was no explicitly religious element to any of them. If because I did get asked this question a bunch in the beginning of my career. I think because it was known that I was observant, and also because of my mom. My mom is the Jewish mystery writer, and so people were wondering, where's that in your novels? I mean, in the sense that I was raised in a specific ethical tradition that obviously provides a backbone to the writing, in the sense that I was raised in a specific intellectual tradition. The one idea, and I think that this is so critical and a skill in rapid decline, one thing that I was really emphasized in my religious training, when you study the Talmud, which is a big part of religious Jewish education, you're taught to get comfortable with the idea that you can hold two competing contradictory ideas in your head at the same time without your head exploding. Like it's possible for two things to be true and for them to contradict each other. And so that is an idea that is critical to me. I think it's, as I said, in short supply and rapid decline in our society. And so a lot of the sort of, I guess, thematic elements of my book are, you know, in response to that idea. With the Golem books, we did get pretty deep into the Jewish weeds there. I don't think you have to be literate in Kabbalistic texts to appreciate the books, but if you are, I think there's an added layer of pleasure and enjoyment there. I would say that, there's one project which I've had on the back burner for many years. I'm continuing to do research on it. It's taken me many, many years. And that is a Jewish family story. It's something that I've been working on while my dad and I collaborate. It's my solo project that's been going on all of this time that we've been working together. And there it's about Judaism, not just as a religion, but as a culture and as an historical milieu. Hopefully I'll get to write it someday and I'll stop researching and actually put words on paper.
He's enjoying the research too
much.
A
little too much.
Okay. Critics and criticism. Now, you've all been celebrated by literary critics, and quite deservedly so, as far as I'm concerned. But all of you have also seen your work treated in, shall we say, unkind ways. So, do you read the criticism? Do you take it seriously? Does it affect your writing in any way?
I used to read it a lot more because my editors used to send me newspaper clips. Mm-hmm. Now with online, everything is online. All the newspapers, all the fans, things, and you have to go searching for what they're saying, and I don't search. I find it very distracting, both good and bad. When I used to read critiquing, everybody loves when you say something nice. I do answer all my own fan mail, and most of the time it's very lovely. The only time I listen to negative comments is if the same negative comment used to appear over and over and over, then I said, maybe I should think about that a little bit more. But if you read enough critiquing of your book, you'll find one person hates one part and the next person will really love that part. So you can't win. It's like arguing with a teenager. There's just no common ground there. No matter what you say, somebody's going to say something different. So, no, I don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I find it distracting from the main job, which is writing the book, which is hard enough. And if I like my book, I'm probably my own harshest critic. Certainly when I turned it into the editor, she turns it back and I said, you didn't do a good enough job of editing. This is not good. This is not good. This has to be changed. If it passes me, I'm pretty happy with it.
I was trained as a scientist and trained to think critically and trained in behavioral medicine, and so I always cast a skeptical eye on most things, but this is yet something else you're not trained to do when you become a novelist. So my first novel, I was very lucky. I was the freak of the week, Shrink Wright's novel. I got a lot of exposure, became a bestseller. I was totally unprepared for it. So then I wrote a second one, and it was a little darker of a book, Blood Test, and then I got a packet, back in the days of packets, of reviews. And some of the articles said, "This is such a sensitive book, it treats tough material in such a sensitive manner, blah, blah, blah." And others, people say, "This guy should be put in jail for writing this disgusting book," basically. So the scientist in me said, "This is all bullshit." And since then, I really haven't paid attention to it. I just think look, I think it's great that we have that, especially with the internet. Anyone with an opinion can voice it. It's unfortunate there's not more self-winnowing, but in a democratic environment, this is what the price we pay for it. And when you put yourself out there and earn a living with something, then that's part of the game. I don't pay much attention to it. I don't pay any attention. I tell them, don't even send me the good reviews. I don't really care. I've written 50 books, and I figure I know how to do it at this point. I know what my intentions are. I know every time I sit down with book number 50, I work as hard as book number one. If you like it, fine. If you don't like it, fine. And then you get cranky stuff. People write crazy stuff. Like, how can the guy eat veal? Okay, fine. I do hate political correctness. I think it's one of the writer's worst enemies. And it can lead you to self-censor. So you have to be free to write what you want to write. And but that said, like Fam, a very tough self-editor. One of the questions we always get asked, what's editing like? And the answer is, it really depends. In some cases, editors have written entire books. Some writers, like E.B. White, didn't want to be...
Not yours, just no, to be clear.
E.B. White, didn't want any editing. I welcome it, as Faye does, but I'm very lightly edited. And the reason is, I'm so perfectionistic. And I thought I was a perfectionist until I started writing with Jess. Oh my God, this is perfectionism taken to a new level. So editors love us, because we hand in really clean stuff. Mm-hmm. We're not perfect. It's a matter of opinion. It's fiction. Some people are going to like it, some people, there's no right or wrong on this. So I just try to do the best book possible and block out the noise. Distraction is the enemy.
You want to say anything about it?
Jesse once told me Jonathan bought a bunch of socks that have famous paintings on them, and one of the paintings on his socks is Munch, the Scream.
Yeah, I have it.
And what Jesse told me is, he's not screaming; he has his head over his ears to block out the noise from around that screaming, and that's what you have to do when you're a writer.
I got acquainted with the notion of criticism and rejection fairly early, because I started submitting some stories for publication when I was 11 years old. I got my first rejection letter at the age of 11. So by the time I published a book at 25, I had been getting rejected for more than half of my life. So I had a fairly thick skin developed by that point. I second everything that they said. I think. For me, there's the added layer of people often come to my work with a certain lens. They expect Jonathan and Faye light, and they're either perplexed or upset or sometimes pleased to see that I don't write like them. We have three very distinct voices. And so a lot of the mail I think I received in the beginning of my career was, oriented around, that perspective. You are not your parents, for good or for ill. I think that I have a pretty good sense now when I read either a critical review. I will say, thankfully, we haven't gotten too many critical reviews. We've all three been treated fairly nicely, mm-hmm, by reviewers. When it comes to a critical review or a critical email, I think I can usually tell whether it's being written in good faith or not, or whether it's being written because somebody's having a bad day, or they just need to lash, or because they're just nuts. Like, you just get letters from crazy people occasionally. I got a very interesting Facebook message a couple weeks ago, which I'm still sort of figuring out how to respond to, and she said, "I love your books. I really enjoy the Clay Edison series, my favorite new character. Could you please make him stop taking the Lord's name in vain?" Because Clay says Jesus or Jesus Christ a couple times. And it's a really interesting... So, your first instinct is, no, fuck off. Like, I'm not... But, she seems like a really nice person, this person. And so I'm sort of like wrestling with how to write back to her. But I thought about it. I thought about what is she getting at? Like, do I have him cuss too much? You know, does he take the Lord's name too frequently? And I think the answer is no, probably no. And I think that it's important to, you know, differentiate between an author and the characters, right? The characters say, and just parenthetically, I think it's so funny the way people will object to things like that, but they don't have a problem with other characters slaughtering people or torturing them or committing acts of art. That's fine, but the Lord's name in vain, that's a big, we got a problem here. I think they often look at your protagonist as you, right? And so they want to hold the protagonist responsible, they want to hold you responsible for everything the protagonist does. But I'm still sort of like map writing a response to her in my head. I felt that what she was saying, while I'm not certainly not going to say, you're right, you know, that's it, no more Jesus. I felt that she was coming from a genuine place and deserves a genuine response. You don't, it's not always the case. Sometimes you just, like I said, you get somebody lashing out in there, it's better to just delete it and sort of move on.
I just want to, if I might throw in another aside about another topic, Jesse mentioned voice. Every writer has a voice. Mm-hmm. One of the most pleasant experiences, when we finished the first Golem book, I sent it to Stephen King, who has, you know, always been very supportive of other writers. And Jesse and Stephen has collaborated with two of his sons, Owen and Joe. And in fact, Jesse's friends with Owen. So we can relate, because they're also a family of writers. And I said, Stephen, what do you think? First of all, he loved the book and voluntarily blurbed it. But then he said, you know, he says, I know your voice and I know Jesse's voice. And you have really created a hybrid voice. So that's what we were out for. And I was very, very happy. That's when you know the collaboration is successful.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Well, one last question for all three of you. It's about time to write. All three of you have active, successful lives outside your work as writers. Faye and Jonathan maintain two homes. You regularly attend Shabbos services, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. You're active philanthropically. And Jonathan is on the faculty of the USC Medical School. Not to be outdone, Jesse is an award-winning playwright as well as a novelist, and he and his wife are raising three children. How do you find time for all that? How much time do you actually spend writing, and is it on a consistent schedule?
Should I answer? Should I?
Yeah.
It's evolved. In my case, first of all, I was a failed writer for many years. I wrote 9 novels that didn't get published over a 13-year period after winning a literary award in college. And those books were written from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. in an unfinished garage because I was working full-time as a psychologist. For 5 years, I had a full-time practice while writing novels. 1990, I finally went writing full-time. And because Faye runs everything else in our life, she's the one you need to talk to because she picks up grandkids, and she always took the kids to school. She always cooked for everybody. I mean, she's just an amazing person, so I'll let
her
talk about that. For me, it's easy because she runs everything, so I'm kind of spoiled. I go in my office and I write. You know, it's not that hard.
Everybody has to find time to do what they want to do, whether it's writing. Y'all work full-time. Mothers work full-time. We're all in the same boat. Fathers work full-time. So if it's important to you, you get it done. I want to go back a little bit more when we were talking about critiquing, and he was talking about this woman who objected to using the Lord's names in vain. Early on in with my series, somebody wrote to me and said, you know, Peter Decker smokes too much. If he keeps smoking at that rate, he's going to be dead before you write the next novel. And you know what? She was right. I went back and looked at all the times he lit a cigarette, and it wasn't that he was even smoking too much. I was using smoking as a crutch. Sometimes you use swearing, smoking, bad habits, everything, because you can't figure out what they're doing with their hands or anything, or you want a segue, so you throw in a swear word or you throw in a drink or a smoke or something like that, and it really is a crutch. So over the years, he's not only quit smoking, I've learned how to pare down things so I don't need as many crutches in that regard. So sometimes a person who points out something that you use frequently, it has merit. don't all of you write to me and say, oh, now this happens or that happens. But you do pare down as you write more often. One of the first things to go when you're a beginning reader to a more experienced reader are all the adverbs. Elmer Leonard, who's an author I admire, cried a bit, said whenever he writes, he looks and writes, then he goes back down and just strikes out all the adverbs. You should be able to see it with an adjective or with a verb. And my writing is leaner because of that, and I think it's better.
In terms of time, I mean, yeah, as my mom said, everybody here is busy. We're all busy. I think that we are fortunate in that this is our job. We don't work other jobs. I don't know how you did that in the beginning, Dad. I certainly couldn't. I think structure is key. And this is true when it comes to structuring your time. It's true when it comes to structuring the book itself. And that's one of the primary lessons I took away from growing up in a household with two writers, is that you have to plan and you have to be professional about it. When you go to work, it's time to work. You're not there sitting there twiddling your thumbs waiting for inspiration to strike. Writing begets more writing. You know, the less you do it, the faster it atrophies. And so you got to put your tuchus in the chair and type. And you know, for me, that means that I'm in the same place at the same time every single day. I get my kids off to school, and then I get up very, very early so I can handle all the sort of daily household stuff and answer emails. Get my kids off to school, and then I'm at my desk, and I don't stop until I've written X number of words. And that word quota has changed over time. You have to be flexible and reasonable with yourself. I used to write 10 pages a day, which is just not doable with three kids. And now it's 3 to 5 pages a day. Once I get 750,000 words, that's a day's work. And some days you write those 750 words or those 1,000 words, and you come back the next day and you delete all of them because they're all garbage. But the important thing is to not lose momentum. Right. I find that when I take an extended break, like we just had, we were all together for Passover, so I didn't work for a couple of weeks. And the first 2 days back are just devoted to shaking off rust. And so the more you keep the machinery turning, the better lubricated it stays.
Yeah, that's certainly true, because you read the book or I read a book and it's a continuum, but we write in small photons or small packets of words every day. And it isn't until we see the final product that we see the whole picture. And sometimes what editors call, there's a lot of seams in there. The book doesn't flow as nicely as you'd want it to do. And that's when the fun part comes, which is the editing, where you go back and you perfect your sentences and you get rid of all your seams. So our readers can read a nice book that goes from point A to point D in a nice straight line and doesn't take, you know, rises and dips.
It's really a job for someone who enjoys the perspiration with the inspiration, to paraphrase Edison. I enjoy refining and shaping. And when I paint, I like to paint in a realistic, meticulous manner. So it suits personality. Also, I think the religious training that Jesse and I had in seminary, it teaches you a certain discipline. We have very rigorous education. Then we went to grad school, all of us. So you it's very well suited to be a disciplined person, and also not to take it too seriously. You know, in the movies, it's always, you're a novelist, and there's fame, and, you know, women love you, and they come up to your signing, and, you know. It's a wonderful job is what it is, but it's a job. And you have to treat it as a job. And all the successful writers that I know have that attitude.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you.
Sure.
So now a question for Faye. You studied math and science as an undergraduate, and you have a doctorate in dentistry, as you mentioned, although you've never practiced, as I understand. Do you find that your background in science influences your writing in any significant way?
Absolutely. That's a good question. I am a math science person, and that's why I said I like to write mystery novels, because there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Like Jonathan said, like Justice said, to write a book, it's you need a lot of delay of gratification. It's a long process. And you have to be prepared for that kind of long process and that kind of discipline. When I was in dental school, one thing dental school did teach me, it taught me a lot of things, but it taught me that you have to prepare beforehand before you actually sit down. You don't want to do dental surgery and then go, oh, where's my curette? Oh, where's this? You know, it has to be all completely laid out before you. And that's kind of how it is with writing. So math and science really did help me. It also helped me pare down things so I wasn't in love with the book itself, and I was more of a disciplined professional writer. I still like my science. I still do a lot of puzzles. I still do a lot of crosswords, a lot of Sudokus and everything like that. It's just one of those things that I am, and I think it lends itself very nice to a certain type of sharp, fast-paced crime writer, and that's what I do.
I want to just tell a story, which is that my mom, a number of years ago, 10, 15 years ago, got a thing in the mail. My mom has never practiced dentistry because she graduated dental school pregnant with me. She got a thing in the mail about a decade ago naming her one of the country's top 1,000 dentists. which I...
She's never hurt anybody.
She's never made a mistake. So
yeah,
it's
never. My patients never complain.
There's no bad reviews on Yelp about my mom.
Okay. Jonathan.
Yes.
Your series of Alex Delaware novels is often referred to as the longest running series of mysteries in the genre. I've read some of the early books and some of the most recent, and I don't detect any sign of boredom or fatigue on your part. Also, you told one interviewer that you had ideas for 60 more novels. Do you intend to keep writing the Alex Delaware series indefinitely?
Yes.
60 more books? Really?
Well, it's more now, because what happens when I get an idea, I write it down, because I'm going to be 70 this summer and I have no short-term memory anymore. So I write it down. So now when I say it's ideas for books, it's paragraphs. It's not an entire outline. But yes, I have lots of ideas. You know, people say, where do you get your ideas? You have a warped mind is where you get your ideas. I used to be snotty about it and say, I got it at Sears. But because there's no real answer. I think a certain type of brain...
Sears also went out of business.
Yeah, they went out of business. a certain type of brain has a certain way. A lot of people have gotten tired of their characters. I love writing the Delaware books because he's a vehicle for telling a certain type of story, and I love him and I love Milo, and I just enjoy... I've enjoyed doing other books. I've written a bunch of standalones too, and now I'm collaborating with Jess, but he is the core of what I do, and I see no reason to stop because I enjoy doing it and people are still buying it. If people stop buying them, I'll stop writing them. That's the way it works. I mean, I hope to have a long life. You never know. My mother will, in January, God willing, be 100, so you know, I have a little bit of genetic thing there, but you never know. I'll be 70 this summer. I don't feel any different from when I was 40 or 30, and I just have to write things down more because I forget the name of the character I put in chapter one.
Okay, now Jesse. Your dad told an interviewer that he's been writing since the age of 9, but you did him one better. When you were 3 years old, you were actually the first in the family to write a series.
That's true.
You dictated to your father a book called Apple of Danger. It was followed by Pear of Danger, Orange of Danger, and Cherry of Danger. What have you got against fruit?
Nothing against fruit, just a strong commercial sensibility, I think. series sell, so that's
so funny. No, and what was funny about it is it shows that it's genetic, because Jesse was born in 1978, and that was 1981. I wasn't published till 85, so he had no idea that I was writing, because I wrote, as I say, from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. He was asleep, so he knew me as a doctor who left, went to the office, and came back. So it just shows that, you know, it's inborn. He would come up to me, he says, Daddy, write this down, you know. And he was just always a great writer.
Did you always want to be a writer? I that's a serious question. I don't know.
I think the answer is I always wrote. So the question is really, did I always want to do this for a living?
Yes.
Right. And because if you love to write, you're always writing, and if you're lucky, at some point somebody starts sending you checks. So in the sense that I thought this was a career, something I could do for a career, that I would enjoy doing for a career. Yes, I didn't take for granted at all that it would be my career. I don't think any writer can do that. I had many backup plans in place, I think that one of the things that, again, people ask me, what did your parents teach you about writing growing up? And the answer is, when it comes to the mechanics of writing, it's not very much, because writing is a private act. I have my own voice, and you really can't impart that information to somebody else. You just have to learn it through trial and error. I think you can guide somebody, you can encourage them, but the skill set you develop, usually it has to be developed in private. The things that I took from watching them growing up were things about professionalism, things about discipline, things about habits. And so I had a sense of what a professional writer's life look like, which I think a lot of writers do not have growing up. A lot of writers are, sort of ex nihilo. And so you have to figure that out on your own. So the advantage that I had is I had two examples of people whose that was their job, and I could look at it and say, okay, this is how you do the job. And also, more importantly, and sort of like more abstract, I could conceive that this was a job, that this was an actual job that people do, and it was possible. I think a lot of times you're writing, you're Emily Dickinson, you're writing in private, and you're not showing it to anybody, and it doesn't even occur to people that this could be something you could make a living doing. I knew that that was possible.
Okay, thank you. So, Faye, while you were writing your books, many of your books, you and Jonathan were raising four children. So I'm wondering how that worked for you. Was talk about soccer games and first dates crowded out by discussions of editorial transgressions and the latest plot twists?
Family time was always family time. It was devoted to the kids. It was devoted to their needs. I tend to be kind of a private person anyway, so the idea of writing and keeping it to yourself and thinking to yourself was not a foreign entity to me. Family was the thing that always came first with both of us, and once the family was taken care of, the kids were in school, that's the time I sat down to write, and I tried to make it the same every day. However, I can write at any time, in any place, and anywhere. I can write in drips and drabs. I can write not sequentially. There are some things where a thought comes to me, and I know it's a chapter like five, at the end, and I want to write that down. So I have a very flexible mind. I can compartmentalize very, very easily. I remember once I was writing that book that didn't get anywhere, and we were in Israel at the time. I was pregnant with my third kid, so I know it's 32 years ago. And the space that they gave me was an unheated, something a little bit bigger than a closet. And I wrote at night because I was on jet lag anyway. We were there for 3.5 weeks for a research book for one of his books. And they had bugs this big. They're called jukim. They're like big, big cockroaches. And one was so big, it had a face. You could see it. Its eyes were staring at me. It was kind of weird up on its hind legs. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I looked at it, and I said, you stay there, I'll stay here, and we'll get along just fine. And we were roommates. We were office mates for a long, long time. So that's been the way that I have dealt with writing.
Yeah, Faye has an amazing mind. I can't do any of that stuff. I'll tell you a brief anecdote. We had a personal assistant many years ago. Her previous boss had been Bruce Springsteen, a fact that she slid into conversation frequently. And she was British. And one day she turned to Faye. She goes, Faye, you're my first boss who cooks. Because, the people she worked for don't cook. And Faye cooked and drove the kids to school. And she was like a total mom. I mean, Jesse, as a child, can attest to it. She did much more than I did. I was a good dad. I wasn't neglectful, but frankly, I would have paid someone to drive the kids to school. And she was up early jogging. And Jesse's some kind of, his wife's a doctor, and she's an executive in a healthcare company, and he's home, and he's writing bestsellers and getting kids off to school and waking up at 4:30 in the morning. It just takes a certain type of work ethic. So I think these two people are very amazing.
I think all three of us would have worked hard at anything we did, and which is the message that you give your kids: find something you love and work really, really hard at it. We're just hard workers.
Which they've all done.
We are married. We have four married children, and they're all eight are gainfully employed, which I think has to be a record of some sort.
And you talk about genetics. We have a writer, two psychologists, two PhD psychologists.
Clinical psychologists.
One adult, one child. And we have another.
One
youngest.
Is in child clinical psychology. Yes. The other is in adult clinical psychology. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And the and then the youngest, who also published a book with Faye at 15, and she wrote it. She's very gifted. She writes, but she's a marketing executive in Austin, Texas, for a company that writes software for big banks. So she's also writing actively. So it's kind of interesting. They stayed kind of close to home without any sort of direct instruction to do so.
Okay. Jesse. According to Francis Dinkelspiel's article about you in Berkeley Side a while back, you were working on a novel about your great aunt who
Yes.
somehow generated a CIA dossier of more than 7,000 pages. You've been getting pieces of the record, reportedly 1,000 pages at a time, through FOIA requests. Mm-hmm. How's that going? Are you close to writing the book?
So this is the novel I alluded to earlier when I talked about what I was writing in the background while collaborating with my dad. It's actually his aunt, my great aunt, Molly. So Molly was my father's mother was the youngest of six. And they were in many ways a very typical immigrant Jewish family. There were three boys born in Europe and then three girls born in America. And they lived in a tenement on the Lower East Side, the eight of them, crammed into a tiny little apartment. And of the six children, four of them went on to lead sort of observant Jewish lives, and two of them became fanatical communists, including my aunt, my great aunt Molly. I didn't really know much about this because it was sort of ancient family history. I didn't discover any of it until my father's brother, my uncle Hillel, sent me a link. This was maybe 11 years ago, saying, "Oh, here's a link to the article from the New York Times when Molly came back from Russia." And I said, "Molly was in Russia?" I had no idea. So I started poking into this, and I just uncovered this unbelievably huge rabbit hole that I've been down now for a decade. In essence, she and her husband were very, very active communists, possibly spies for the Soviet Union, and they took the unusual step of actually defecting to the Soviet Union in 1959, which at that point, if you know much about American history, that was a very late date to be an active communist. Most the American Communist Party was very, very, sort of had its heyday in America during World War II when we were allied with the Soviet Union. But afterward, because of McCarthyism and because of the Cold War, they were really sort of, their ranks were considerably diminished. But Molly was a true believer. She and her husband were true believers, and they hung on till well beyond the point of no return, and actually ended up going to Russia to live there. So I started with the FOIA request just sort of after I got this article from my uncle. I said, well, let's just send a FOIA letter and let's see what comes back. So I said, I didn't know anything about this process at that point. I wrote probably the world's worst FOIA letter. I failed to include any information that would have helped identify. It was just an absolute disaster of a letter. And I heard nothing, so I sort of forgot about it. And I would poke around on the internet periodically and look for articles about her. And then 5 years later, I got an email from the National Archives saying, we started preparing your request. Your aunt, the FBI files for your great aunt and her husband, it's not the CIA files, it's the FBI files. They total 7,000 pages. So we're going to process it in stages because that's too much to do at once. So they gave me about 1,000, 1,500 pages, which was like, an unbelievably great shock to me. I had no idea that it was that extensive. And I remember corresponding with the archivist at NARA, and I said, well, when do I get the next 1,000 pages? She said, your request goes to the back of the queue, so you'll get it in another 5 years. So I actually just got the second batch about 2 months ago. But along the way, so when I started reading the first 1,000 pages, I realized how much there was there. And so I started learning about the FOIA process and basically just FOIAing everything. I'm like their worst nightmare now because now I can write a FOIA letter in 5 minutes. So I've FOIAed justice and I've FOIAed passport and I've FOIAed state and I've FOIAed the Bureau of Prisons. And most of those have been successful. I've gotten back well over 10,000 pages worth of material at this point. The one place I'm having a lot of trouble is the CIA. The CIA, and I apologize if there's any CIA agent, but the CIA, they are bastards. They are so difficult, because they have sort of a blanket provision to say no, and that's just what they do reflexively. So I've appealed it up and up and up and up the chain, and it is currently I'm at my last appeal right now. So either I'll get that or I won't. But, I know they have stuff. I have the file numbers. They do this very coy thing of saying, well, we can't confirm or deny.
That's the CIA.
It's the CIA. So, and I understand why those provisions exist, but I don't think they count. Usually, I think they're relying on the fact that most people will do one and they'll say, okay, forget it, But that's I got time, so they're going to get letters.
I'm not giving anything away, but I hope he writes a book because there's a trove of comedic material in there. You have no imagination.
It's really crazy. Like,
crazy stuff.
Such
a waste of time.
She was an interesting person, just in the way, briefly that I described. But when I started to open up this trove of documents, I found all these other things that they had done and gone through, and it sort of opened up a whole world to me. So I'm hoping I can corral it into something narratively coherent at some point.
I lived through this as a child because she was my aunt. And they went to Russia and then they couldn't get out.
Yeah.
So that was the issue.
Yeah.
You couldn't get out.
Yeah.
And it really distressed my grandparents a lot. It was very, very stressful. And I remember finally when they came out, was it 1960?
64.
64. I'm 14 years old. My mom says, we're going to New York. We lived in L.A. And we take this, it was the dead of winter, and we go and we sit in a park bench, my sister, my mom, and myself. And I have no idea really why we're there. And then out of the fog comes my aunt. Like a movie drifting. She hadn't seen my mom in 4 or 5 years. But we had to do it in a covert manner because my dad owned an electronics company and he was a defense subcontractor and he was so nervous about it. Really amazing that despite all the CIA, FBI stuff, no one bothered him. But it was a strange. So I didn't really. For me, it's what I grew up with. To him, it's exotic.
Right. I remember. I started looking into this, and to me, it was like, this, I can't believe.
And she was a lunatic.
Yeah.
She was a total. The one thing I'll say about my aunt is, she had a horrible voice, and she'd sing opera. And she's in the subway in New York, and two guys look like they're coming over to mug her, and she starts singing opera, and they got the hell out of there.
True story. Okay. At our wedding, she was there at his mom's house, and another aunt was there at her house. They were sisters-in-law, and they got into a huge fight, each one claiming they snored louder than the other one. So, it's family.
Okay, well, we've got a little more than 15 minutes left, so I'm going to cut off this portion of the presentation, and we're going to go to questions from you.
Thank you very much, Mel.
Oh,
it was great.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So we have a mic or two mics. We have mics on either end. If you want to speak, want to ask a question, then please just go up to talk to one of the people with the mics. Oh, all right. They're going to go around, I guess. All right.
I think this is really remarkable, and I was just wondering, I know James Lee Burke and his daughter are both novelists,
yeah.
But she works in Upper New York, he just moved to, I think, Montana or Wyoming, but he's very rooted in Louisiana. How much does environment and maybe generations kind of separate how your main characters kind of grow, develop? Because James Lee Burke's last book, now he's 75, and now his Dave Robichaux is very, you know, kind of back into reminiscing now. He's not so active anymore. How do you feel about that?
I have chosen not to age my characters in real time. Nobody wants to read about a 70-year-old guy solving crimes. Environment, well, Miss Marple, but, you know, I just kept Delaware the age he was basically when I started, mid-30s. Environment's always been really important to me. I consider Los Angeles a character in my novels.
Correct.
I mean, that's one of the things I was very much taken by Ross McDonald, to a lesser extent, Raymond Chandler, but McDonald specifically, Southern California, has always been a character in my novels. I did do a book in Jerusalem called The Butcher's Theater because I love Jerusalem. It's a fascinating place. And, you know, Czechoslovakia and things like that, but I'm definitely consider myself an L.A. writer. Mm-hmm. In terms of not aging, I mean, I honestly, without being snippy, I don't feel any different than when I started. So I just don't want to lapse into that type of, there's a little bit, you know, I mean, you have to change with the times. As Jesse's pointed out to me reading my early books, there's no cell phones, there's pay phones, so you don't want to be an anachronism. I've lived long enough to be an anachronism, but basically I've just, like doing the same thing.
My characters have aged in not quite as old as when they started out. They would be older. But my character, Peter Decker, is semi-retired, and he works for the small police station now, and I enjoy it. As far as atmosphere and environment is concerned, like John said, it is a character in the book. You I don't want to set my scenes so that they could be in Boston or in an interchangeable with Selma, Alabama. They have to be rooted in some sort of environment. And to me, when you write, it's not just about characters. It's about using all of your senses. So if they're rooted in an environment, you have to smell the air. You have to look. You have to look at there. You have to taste what they're tasting. It all helps to create the books. That's how I feel.
We have, my dad and I, the series that we're currently working on, which is the Clay Edison series, is set here because I live here. And this is an inescapable, writing about this place is impossible to write about it without going into detail because it's such a distinctive place, Berkeley in particular, but the East Bay in general. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I've really enjoyed learning about is how, you know, being a cop here is different than being a cop in Los Angeles, being a cop in New York, et cetera. And so, sure it, you know, as you've probably discerned, I'm a research junkie, and so learning those nuances is a great deal of the pleasure of the process for me.
Great, thank you.
I'm asking partly about structure and then secondarily about collaboration. I guess the structured part is, when you guys start a book, do you have the beginning and the middle of the end all, you know what it's going to be, you know, and it's all there? And then when you're going to collaborate, does one of you go chapters 1, 2, 3 and then hand it out to the next guy, takes it up and writes 4, 5, 6, or do you say, I'll do the first act, you do the second act, you know, et cetera?
In terms of structure, I can just say what I do, and I think Faye and Jesse also. I outline. My books evolve from that list of 60 to 80 stories, and then I do a lot of thought. I mean, it's a year-long process for me, half of which is spent before I sit down writing. It's outlining, it's thinking. And then I write general outlines. I get up in the middle of the night, I make notes. Then I write a structure, chapter-by-chapter outline. Now, some writers don't. Bob Parker didn't. Elmer Leonard didn't. I'm not that smart. My books have a lot of plot, and I have to keep it straight. So that said, once I do the outline, I rarely look at it. Then at the end of the book, I've written a totally different book. So, yeah, structure is important. It's
Writing's an interesting job. I just gave a lecture at the Classical Guitar Society down in Southern California, and it was called Fundamentals and Improvisation. Because that's what writing is. You have grammar, spelling, structure, logic, and then it's all the crazy stuff that propels writing fiction. In terms of how Jesse and I write, we do drafts and redrafts. We don't do separate chapters. One of us will, and now it's mostly Jesse does a first draft, I do a second draft, third draft, and we keep passing drafts back and forth until we're happy. That's how we do it.
How many times do you pass it?
Oh boy.
You passed it back on this latest book?
And we have a lot of meetings and talks.
Yeah,
we sort of have
periodic, powwows to figure out where we're going. How many times do we? I don't know.
Half a dozen.
Yeah, something a lot.
Uh-huh.
And also each of us is when we write, we have a habit of starting each day by rewriting the previous day's material. So by the time it's done, it's been polished literally dozens of times.
Wow.
Wonderful. You need to pass it back and forth to get a coherent voice.
Yeah.
It's what you do in solo writing. You're passing it back and forth, but here you're doing it with another person. And as long as the other person has good chops, then it works out okay.
All right.
Let me preface this question by saying I'm really not very familiar with your work.
So. Not a prerequisite of American citizenship, though it should be.
And I'll direct it more towards Jonathan, but it's really for everyone. And that is, obviously, you've created a wonderful platform. You have millions of people that read your books. And you mentioned before you want to continue until people don't buy them, which to me means either it's a commercial interest or entertainment you feel a responsibility for. My question is, at what point do your own political or social values play a role in terms of the fact you've got this huge audience that respects you and you can be making statements indirectly that are meaningful?
It's an interesting question. My philosophy is, if you have a message, use Western Union.
Or the internet.
Of course, every part of a writer is going to come out. I don't want to alienate anybody. I'm not interested in being a pundit. I've written a few op-ed pieces, and no matter how benign they are, someone gets pissed off at you. I don't need it, you know. I just want to write a novel that makes me feel good. I'm a musician, too. I want to play music, and I don't want to really worry about the other stuff. Of course, stuff's going to come in. I created the first gay character in mainstream fiction. It wasn't necessarily an altruistic thing. It was more, hey, this is interesting. So I'm happy about that. But reaction to it, here's a good example why you don't want to get political. When the Delaware novels first came out, so I got awards from gay organizations and was like, oh, you know, and people would write me and say, I'm gay and I like mysteries and they've been so homophobic, thank you so much, blah, 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 blah. Or guys writing in, I'm just like Milo, I'm just that kind of guy. Then it kind of morphed into, how can Kellerman as a straight man presume to write about the gay experience? So no good deed goes unpunished. So I really try to
avoid the end sentence.
And then the M thing was a reviewer in a gay magazine in England who said, if Delaware was really that good of a shrink, you know he really has a crush on Milo. So I don't think my political views are worth any more than anyone else's just because I'm a novelist or have a PhD. So I don't think I have a right to inflict my views on anybody else. And if it comes out in a subtle manner, hopefully a message of humanism, a message of kindness, a measure of justice. But I'm not out to make a statement.
I feel exactly the same way. I'm really out to entertain. And the most rewarding thing that you can say about my novels, and some fans came back where they say, I was in the hospital and I was in a dark place, and your novels just took me out of it for 2 hours. They're escapism. I want you to enjoy the novel. I want you to escape. Life can be very, very tough. And as a writer who wants to entertain you, I want to take you out of your life for a couple of hours and just let you relax.
And I guess my perspective comes from my background as a psychologist. I had a very wide patient range. And it was never about me. If you came into my office, there wasn't a picture of my family on that wall. There wasn't anything about me. Because my job was to concentrate on you. And I'm not going to inflict my judgment and my views on you. I don't really care about anything but helping you.
as a psychologist. In terms of being commercial, of course it's commercial. If I can't make a living at it, then I start to feel like when I was a rejected writer, I'll go play guitar. But, you know, I mean, you want to be appreciated like anything else. So is the goal commercial? No, the goal is to write the best book possible and to be amazed each time that a certain amount of people go out and buy it. It's an amazing thing still, you know.
I would say that, I mean, one of the nice things about writing, and so a novel is a very, as my mom says, a very slow art form. It takes a long time to write a novel, to think about a novel, to read a novel. It's in many ways the antithesis of sort of the discourse of the moment, which is instantaneous and reactive. You know, insofar as the series that we're collaborating right now is set here, and this is a political place. The series touches on here and there. It touches on some of the issues that are particular to this geography, but the goal is to do it in a way that is nuanced and not reactive. And I think that I guess I don't want to be writing in slogans. You know, I think slogans are cheap. I think slogans are easy, and in many ways, it's not what the novel is designed to do. The novel is designed to complicate things, not simplify them. And you know, as you alluded to, like the very power of a platform and the power of having a wide audience requires that you exercise caution and restraint. That's my feeling. Obviously, a lot of writers feel differently. There's some writers who are very politically active or very, very vocal on Twitter and whatnot. That's just—it's not who we are as people. We're not people who I think are attention-seeking in that way. We have our own opinions. I think for me, as I said before, one of the most important values is understanding that people can disagree and still coexist. No, they can't. Someone's shaking his head back there. Insofar as I'm trying to make any statement, it's a message of, like, you know, slow down and reflect. That would be where I'm.
Like we said, it's fiction.
Yeah. To the extent that I'm remembered for anything, I want to be remembered as someone who made people feel better.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
I'm interested in your development of a voice. Each of your works has a very distinctive voice, and you've talked about developing a hybrid voice in those works that you've collaborated on. I'm wondering how you go about developing a voice, and then how you can be sure it's an authentic one.
Why don't you start?
In my experience, most writers, and this is true of a lot of artists, start out as imitators. You start out as a reader, right? Most people start out as readers and listeners before they are writers, and so. Your training is to copy in the way that painters copy old masters. And so a lot of my early writing sounded like Stephen King, and then when I started writing plays, I sounded like David Mamet. I think it's that process of trying on different identities that you find the aspects of each that sort of actually click into place with you. For me, the voice, because I write standalone novels, the voice varies from novel to novel. And it's really the process of finding your voice is a process of learning about the character. I think that I try to actually be a little bit like a chameleon in writing, and then whatever the demands of that character are, to adapt my voice accordingly. In terms of how we know it's authentically, I mean, it's... I don't know. I'm not sure there is. It is authentically. I mean, it's an artifice, right? It's a magic trick. I mean, some people write Romana Clay. Some people write themselves. That's not what I do, and it's not what we do. And actually, the fun is getting to not be yourself for a little bit.
Right. Oh,
I think we need to wrap up. I've been instructed not to go over time.
Okay.
Books are for sale outside, and our illustrious authors will happily sign them.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, everybody.
Hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.